Good morning. Your ability to get information online and in court top our talk list. Today is the last day to submit comments on the FCC's proposed rules covering net neutrality. Former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps gives us his read of the over 1 million comments received so far. The Hawaii Supreme Court ruling on open trials made headlines this week. Law professor Ken Lawson looks at the nuances of the decision and its timing. On Friday, July 18th, it's The Conversation.
And trends in floral design come and go. On Kauai, they're keeping design styles fresh and appealing at the Aloha Floral Design Studio Show. We'll talk with its coordinator, Johnny Gordine. And it's a big year for the Bailey House Museum. Executive Director Sissy Lake Farm previews plans for the museum's bicentennial. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. The Conversation starts after this news. And maybe you're humming along too. Good morning and happy Aloha Friday. You're listening to The Conversation. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. People do understand what net neutrality is.
Well, apparently so. Yeah. Apparently so. Taking a look at how many comments, the overwhelming amount of comments that have come in, as even of last Wednesday when there was well over a million, we'll find out how many more have come in since then. That's the subject of our first conversation. And if anyone wondered if the American public really cared about net neutrality, maybe that question is now being put to rest by all those comments sent to the FCC about its proposed rule. One man who will not say he told you so, but who's very glad to see the response, is former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps. He's again been traveling across America, now back to Washington, D.C., where he joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you?
Doing pretty well, thanks. And apparently so is the response to the FCC's proposed rules. When we checked last time, it was about, 1,030,000, and that was a couple of days ago. Numbers haven't come out exactly today, but more of them have been coming in, I would imagine, especially since that line to the FCC was fixed, which was thwarting a lot of people's ability to give their comments.
Isn't it wonderful? I am so encouraged that even in this age when the special interests wield so much power and they have so much money to wield public opinion and are so used to getting their own way that the grassroots can speak up, and that's the movement I see taking shape right now. You know, it's going up like 100,000 a day all week, and as you mentioned, it went over a million yesterday. I don't know what it's at today, but it's really encouraging, but on the other hand, I don't want people to think that the battle's over and we can start declaring victory, because we've got a long way to go on this. There is no evidence that the commission has been moved one way or the other by these comments. I hope commissioners will look at them and take them to heart, but all the special interests, all that money, all that influence is being wielded on the other side, and we've got to use every day between now and such time as the commission votes to keep this grassroots input coming in.
People still have an opportunity today to be able to respond to the proposed rules, and then there's going to be the comments on the comment period, so it's far from over, as you make.
It's far from over. Some people had thought originally the FCC would maybe vote as early as September. I don't think they're going to really be voting probably until later in the year. Time is our friend on something like this. No question about that. So we need to take advantage of that. And every day we get 100,000 messages in every day. That'd be great. Just so people don't get the idea that the battle's over, or just sending in your comments one time and then waiting until the commission votes. We need to be out talking about it, writing about it, marching about it, doing everything we can. It's really important stuff.
I mean, there are those who have come in with lots of comments and hand deliver them to make the point. Others who have called in and left comments, not necessarily using, you know, email as a way of doing that. But the FCC says that it's going to read through all of those comments. Will they really?
Well, I hope so. I don't expect every commissioner is going to. I served there for 11 years, and you know, you don't get to read over a million comments. But people in the bureau are being keeping up with them. I think commissioners have a pretty good idea what those comments are saying. When we went through an exercise like this back in 2003, when then Chairman Michael Powell was trying to loosen the media ownership rules, which he was trying to let fewer of these big media companies own more and more stations. We had millions of people writing in to Congress and the FCC then, too, and it had an effect. It didn't stop the commission from approving the rules, but it encouraged Congress, it persuaded Congress to overturn those rules. So I think the commissioners will know. They'll see some of this input. They'll know that 90 or 95% or whatever it is on the right side of the question, or at least on the side of the question that I think is the right side.
Specifically, let's talk about that.
There's no question these comments do have an impact. Keep them coming.
Specifically, let's talk about the right side as you see it.
Well, the right side as I see it is aware of how important a role the Internet is playing in our economy and in our democracy, realizes that it is the central communications platform of the 21st century, and that it should not be allowed to have toll booths and have gatekeepers controlling where you go on the Internet, what content you can access, or letting industry's favorite friends buy faster lanes on that Internet, ending up with an Internet that serves the needs of the 1% and ignores the needs of the 99% is not something we can afford to do with this powerful platform. You know, the Internet is so dynamic, so full of potential, and to let it go down the road that radio and TV and cable went down, with consolidated companies, a few companies controlling it, would just be a tragic, I think, tragedy of historic proportions. So this is making sure that we don't have a cableized Internet. This is making sure that the consumer is in charge to the maximum extent possible of their Internet experiences day in and day out.
We talked about net neutrality years and years ago, and that sort of is what prompted the intro to this conversation. Do people really get it now? Well, clearly they do. What happened to make us so ripe for understanding net neutrality?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because I think a few years ago I referenced when we had this battle over the media ownership rules, and even though we kept some bad things from happening then, I think a lot of the folks who were, the Internet was just getting into high gear then, so it wasn't anything like it is now. And I think a lot of it's the users then thought, well, this Internet is, this broadband is so dynamic, it's not going to be subject to those same laws of economics and profit-seeking and market control and monopolization that those earlier communication systems were, because the Internet is, as I said, so awesome and so dynamic. And I think now they've realized, seeing what's happening with all of these mergers, seeing what's happening with these attempts to gatekeep, folks are all beginning to realize, hey, wait a minute, this does concern me, it does concern here and now, and this is a piece of public policy that's hugely important to the future of our democracy. This isn't just about, you know, how we classify something, and you can get in the weeds and net neutrality so quickly. But I'm trying to just explain to people, this is about small d democracy. We turn this Internet and this technology over to those who can decide what websites you can go to, or which websites are speeded up, or maybe they don't like some advocacy clause so they can block it. We have really, really put the brakes on our civic dialogue if we let that happen. And
we can't
afford it, not with the problems this country is facing right now.
Well, we're going to not have many months to find out how this begins to play out as people comment up until today, and then have the comment on the comment period that will run into September. And we'll talk to you as we move into the fall. Thanks so much for making
us. Well, that's wonderful, and thank you for covering this issue. And thanks to everybody out there who's taken part, participated, and keep it up.
And thanks very much for making us us a priority in your schedule. We know you've been crisscrossing the country yet again. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Michael Copps is a former commissioner of the U.S. Federal Communications Commission. He's now a special advisor for Common Cause and the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. It's 8:14 later in the show, chasing worldwide trends in floral design. But first, your quiz.
U.S. First Ladies have had varying degrees of recognition and fame over the years, and that would include interest in their travel plans. The subject of today's backyard quiz is no exception. Decades ago, this former First Lady took a trip to Hawaii, and although she had not been the First Lady for several years, she was still a celebrity and a global icon. When her plane touched down in Honolulu, over 5,000 people were there to greet her. Over the course of her stay, the former First Lady attended events with notable local figures, camped on the outer islands, and even took lessons in Chinese calligraphy. On the East Coast and even abroad in Europe, the media and the public followed her everywhere, but in Hawaii, she could relax. The governor requested that she and her family be given privacy, and the Star Bulletin and Advertiser agreed not to follow or report on the family's daily activities. In a grateful letter to both papers at the end of her seven-week stay, she wrote, quote, "I hope the aloha spirit is contagious because it could change the world." For this morning's quiz, can you name this former First Lady? If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're stumped, well, just wait. We'll have the answer for you next half hour.
Aloha, I'm J.C. Mikulanik from Good Beginnings Alliance. You're tuned to HPR 2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
There's more to floral arranging than relying on the beauty of the flowers themselves. It's what you do with them. It's a refined and complex art with an international following and an ever-changing landscape. This Sunday's Kauai Aloha Design Studio Workshop is giving Hawaii floral designers a chance to learn about worldwide trends in their craft from two members of the American Institute of Floral Designers. Johnny Gordinas is coordinating the event. He's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Johnny.
Good morning. Is this Chris?
It sure is.
How are you, sir?
Not too bad. I get the impression that there's a lot more to this world than the layman might know about. Am I right?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, how does that manifest itself, Johnny?
Well, actually, this is a great treat for Hawaii and the island of Kauai. We are bringing in two of the most renowned educators and floral designers in the world. Utomi Gilliam, who is from Canada, and as you mentioned, a member of the elite American Institute of Floral Designers, and her counterpart, Ms. Lois Hironaga, he is a Maui girl. And they will be featured for our workshop this Sunday at the Kauai Beach Resort from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Johnny, we'll give the dates and times and things. I'm more interested in the subject of floral design itself. And I get the impression that it's a pretty complex world with its own language, its own aesthetic. Is that true?
That is correct, especially since the tropical flowers, we have several organizations and University of Hawaii that went on a search in Central America. So most of the tropical flowers originated in Central America, and they brought them back to Hawaii, and it's put up a whole new level of floral design. They're big, they're bold, they're beautiful, they have fantastic colors, and it takes a professional to show what you can do in with the tropical flowers that grow so well here in our climate here in Hawaii.
What are some of those, Johnny?
Well, we're talking about heliconias, which are all related to the banana family. We're talking about red gingers and cerquorums and pendant hanging heliconias, beautiful orchids, anthuriums, and potted plants, and the list goes on and on. They're similar to the bird of paradise that everyone is really familiar with nowadays.
But these are Central American in origin. I didn't realize that.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
When did that quest for Central American plants, roughly when did that take place?
That took place in the early 90s, and a germplasm collection was established here on the island of Kauai. And as the varieties grew out and became plentiful, then we distributed them to the rest of the islands. So most of the islands have a germplasm collection, and they're all the tropical flower growers like myself have all the different varieties now.
I'm sorry, Johnny, what was that term you just used? A what collection?
Germplasm.
What is that?
Germplasm is a collection of different varieties of a product.
Uh-huh.
And in this case, it's the heliconias, okay?
So that's kind of how the seed, if you will, of bringing a new plant to the islands, huh?
Correct. The heliconias can be propagated either by seed or by rhizome, the root portion of them.
Uh-huh. So that's how you introduce...
They propagated and divided and transplanted out in the open.
So for a designer, of course, these are like colors to a painter's palette, yeah?
That's correct.
And...
So there's quite a spectrum of colors when it comes to the tropical flowers. Quite a spectrum of colors.
Well, I mean, the layman might think that in Hawaii, with the flowers available to us here, you sort of can't go wrong, but obviously in the more refined world of floral design, there's a lot of specific criteria. Is that fair to say?
What do you mean by specific criteria besides that people, are you saying that people need to, what they need to familiarize themselves with the varieties and how to construct a floral arrangement with these new flowers that are really not that old? You know, it's maybe a little over 15 or so years old. The new varieties have come out.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm trying to understand, Johnny, is how the aesthetic works. You know, is there such a thing as too much of a certain color? Can you throw something out of balance by putting the wrong flower in? I mean, they're all beautiful in one way or another.
Well, actually, the beauty of the tropical flowers is because the colors are so bright and the flowers are large and they're bold, you don't need a lot of tropical flowers to make a statement in a flower arrangement as compared to your temperate flowers like roses and chrysanthemums and jabaras and a lot of the flowers that are used on the mainland. And actually, the latest trend within the floral industry is mixing the tropical flowers with the temperate flowers to get the best of both worlds.
So you might have your brightest color come from a tropical import, like what you describe, but then you kind of flesh out your design with places, flowers from different origins, yeah?
Right. They complement each other. There's different colors on both sides of temperate flowers and tropical flowers. There's different textures that are used in design work. There's different lines that can be used in the design work because of the shapes of the tropical flowers and then the temperate flowers that will to complement the floral design work.
Well, Johnny, it sounds as if there's a great deal to learn, and I thank you for taking the time. Johnny Gordinas is the coordinator of the Kauai Aloha Design Studio Workshop, Intimate to Ultimate, The Art of Celebrating with Hawaiian Flowers. It's on Sunday at the Kauai Beach Resort from 11 to 5 p.m., and you can get details at hpr2.org.
Imagine a t-shirt you never have to wash, yet it could kill bacteria and even change color to match your favorite sports team. I'm Ira Flato on Science Friday. We're fashioning the clothes of the future. Plus a pacemaker made from heart cells designed to reprogram the heart to beat better. All on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
And you know, we'll all be listening with you. Hawaii Public Radio salutes its family of station members. Membership support keeps the programming we all count on and enjoy coming our way every broadcast day. Mahalo to Yoshiko Kobayas of Honolulu, Hoyt and Diane Parker of Wahiwa, and Garnett Smith and Patricia Edlin Smith of Kailua for your recent gifts. We're proud to count you among HPR's growing family of members. Join the people who are making a difference through their station membership. Call us at 955-8821 during business hours, or you can go online and click the support link on hpr2.org. There's little data and no regulation over what was once billed as a way to quit smoking. And that has a lot of people wondering whether e-juice vapor is really better than cigarettes or just another addiction in the making. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning and Aloha Friday, Beth Ann.
And to you, too. When we go out and just out and about town, it seems that there's a proliferation of these, you know, e-vapor, e-cigarettes, and just watching these curls waft through the air because they can go places where people who are smoking cigarettes can't go.
That's right. And, you know, we have a pretty thorough ban on cigarettes, tobacco use in the state. There's almost no place besides your home or your car, a few exceptions here and there. And yet, e-cigs, e-cigarettes, these devices, as you say, can be used just about anywhere. I believe there are a few places that don't allow them. I don't think you can use them on Honolulu buses, for example, or in Consolidated Theater. The Department of Health, by the way, has also banned their use. But the question is, are they harmful not only to the user, but is there possibly some secondhand effects as well to people walking by? These things are not known yet.
And that's part of the problem, that they are just all over the place because they're unregulated, and because we don't have a whole lot of data on them. There are some fears among some in the anti-smoking community, anti-tobacco, that these are somehow going to renormalize the idea of smoking with a product that we just don't know nearly enough about.
In fact, one of the marketing slogans for one of the companies, Blue, B-L-U, that makes these e-cigs is, take back your freedom, right? So, you know, you can't smoke cigarettes, you're trying to quit that addiction, so you pick this liquid nicotine device up, and will that give you the nicotine fix? Sure, but what's in that substance? What kind of chemicals? There is evidence that they do still contain toxins and carcinogens, and so the FDA has yet to establish any regulations, but there are some studies underway to try and find out exactly what's in there.
And looking at whether the high temperature, the burn rate, is actually causing some of those chemicals to recombine and to create a carcinogen.
Right, and whether, in fact, what you're doing is ending one addiction for another. So these are the kind of things we have to find out. In the meantime, there's been a push legislatively. I mentioned the Department of Health, Tobacco Coalition, or rather the Coalition for Tobacco-Free Hawaii, they pushed for a couple of bills last session. One of them would have been a tax, you know, like we tax cigarettes. Another would have raised the age limit to 21. And then another bill would have limited where you could use them, similar to cigarettes. But they all died in part because there's no compelling factual evidence on what e-cigarettes do to the body.
Which is to say that we're sort of in this situation, perhaps as we were with cigarettes way back in the day, waiting for enough information and data to catch up to prove to people what some already knew, which was maybe this is not such a good idea and maybe darn not harmful.
Exactly. And then labeling, of course, is what happened with cigarettes back in the 50s and 60s, early 60s.
So now we have some studies that the FDA is doing, and anything locally?
There are some research going on, nothing I would point to quantitatively or qualitatively, still in the early days, but my guess is within the next year or so, we will see some new data.
All right, we're going to leave it there for this Aloha Friday. Have yourself a good weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.
Thanks, Beth Ann. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Chad. Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Good morning, I'm Chris Vandercook, and it's 8:29. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Stay tuned for a look at the after effects of a pivotal Hawaii Supreme Court ruling. But first, the news from Deutsche Welle.
Bill Dorman just walked into the studio. That must mean it's Friday. Good morning.
It's true. Good morning, Bethany.
I'm taking a look at what's happening, you know, politically. One of the big questions has been, where are the polls?
Yeah, where are the polls? You know, we're in this season. The first batch of absentee ballots, as you know, go out in the mail today. And tomorrow it's 3 weeks from the primaries. And the public surveys, I mean, polls are going on. And I'm sure a lot of listeners have gotten phone calls, sometimes annoying ones, about
at dinner time.
Yeah, exactly, at dinner time and asking about that. But then it has not been of the nature of public polls, that in a lot of races for a lot of things, you know, you see these disclosed and who is leading whom and all of that. These are private polls. These are done for the campaigns. The campaign's doing it themselves, but they're very closely held. What we haven't seen this time around is a regular sort of diet of polls that are publicly released and that have some indication. When it comes to politics, there's something called the tracking poll, you know, which shows over time, so there's a degree of consistency, so you can see how voter preferences are affected. And you don't want to, on the one hand, you don't want to break every aspect of political coverage down to the horse race, you know, mentality. But at the other hand, it is part of the story that really we're not getting to.
Yeah, seeing that stream and being able to track that through time a little bit and see how the candidates are regarding each other in how they release their poll information, too.
Exactly.
It seems to be missing this time.
It's all part of the picture. And part of the picture, of course, also has to do with cost. You know, it's about $20,000 to run a poll. Some of this, you know, you can raise the question of whether things like concentration of media ownership have something to do with this, because you're not in a situation where competing media are saying, oh, here's our poll, no, here's our poll, and comparative. Anyway, Wayne Yoshioka is going to take a swing at some of those issues, and we'll see what he has to say.
Next week, you're also going to take a look at some innovative food programs for seniors, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the Hawaii Food Bank, a group that does such good work on so many levels in different parts of the community, really sort of a, you know, Kapuna Veggies program, I think of it. They're passing out food vouchers for low-income seniors that are redeemable for fresh produce at local farmers markets. This is part of a program that's set up with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, but it's something, again, that people may not be aware of, and Molly Salmon's going to look into that and sort of tell us some more details about it and how people can make use of it.
And one more thing before you go, because we've all heard that Spamalot is opening. We're going to get a little taste of that from perhaps Noe?
Yes, exactly. Noe's going to do this. You know, I didn't know where the title of this came from. There's a line
Seriously.
In the play. We eat ham and jam and spam a lot. So that's, you know, there's a local aspect to this, too. There's always a local angle in Hawaii, I tell you.
And everything when it comes out of our newsroom. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is Hawaii Public Radio's news director. And you know what else we do on a Friday? We have a look at your posts and your email.
Following Tuesday's show about a possible ban on foam takeout containers, we got a couple of Facebook comments, including this one from Tanya Duaris Bush. I listened to the show and heard about the sanitary concerns that consumer containers perhaps would be dirty. Really appreciated that concern. Just wondering how we are enforcing clean and sanitized kitchens across the state. Sometimes I wonder if there is a Department of Health monitoring our restaurant kitchens. When I see something clean, I praise them. Clean seems to be an exception.
Chris's conversation with the author of The Dawn of Global Sense generated this email. Judah Fried is right about people following bad, strongmen type alpha male leaders because of a need to feel safe. But ironically, a similar phenomenon is a key in the New Age movement. People are so desperate for guidance and spiritual comfort, they'll follow gurus like Fried, Deepak Chopra, etc., who convince them to believe things that simply aren't true, like we are made of light and your thoughts supernaturally control the universe and will make you successful and the universe isn't real. Johann Peter.
Following last week's town square on youth activism, this arrived. I just discovered your radio station yesterday. It was amazing to hear more about youth activism in Hawaii. Tuning in for more, Demeliza Saramosing. And Bart Dame left us this comment. I was unaware of Molly Solomon prior to her covering political speed dating. She worked very hard on the story, stayed the whole time, sat in on the groups and interviewed audience members and candidates to produce her report. I may have to subscribe to a podcast of HPR now that I have seen her work. It is not just good activists who help deepen our vitiated democracy. It is also good journalists. And we have several dedicated souls working in those trenches.
Thanks very much for being in touch. You can write to us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or email us about anything you hear on HPR2 at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This week, Hawaii's media and you received resounding support from the Hawaii Supreme Court to not be shut out of a public trial. The ruling answered a challenge to the judge's actions in the trial of Christopher Didi. At issue was her instruction to clear the courtroom and seal transcripts. While the decision now serves as a warning to other judges, the opinion also provides for circumstances for private proceedings if there is an overriding interest. Where that line might be in making the case for that interest is why UH Law Professor Ken Lawson stopped by our studio earlier this morning, and I asked him how much timing and our heightened sensitivities played into the ruling.
When you have a case this high profile, as the Didi case is, with so much local interest, I mean, probably more local interest in any case in the last several years, the public wants to know that what's going on. The public wants transparency. And so when the judge decided at this juncture, especially with everything that had happened in that trial up until that point, if you can remember what was going on last summer and everything, now all of a sudden we're having these secret meetings and the press is locked out and no one knows what's going on and there's just a bunch of speculation. It leads to people thinking, you know what, there's something going on behind closed doors. It's just not kosher, right? That somehow justice doesn't appear to be just because we don't know what's going on. And so to keep those hearings secret and to seal the transcripts, even after the trial was over, created even more speculation. I just, you know, personally, as a law professor and a former lawyer, I just wanted to know what was going on, you know. What's the big deal, right? And so when we got a chance to see the transcripts, I'm looking at it like, you know, same way the Hawaii Supreme Court did. There's no need for this, you know. She did not show a compelling reason whatsoever to seal those transcripts and to close off the media or the public.
And that seemed to be the big question, you know, the why of it, especially once we saw what was in them. It's like, well, why would she have done this? Now, we can speculate up one side and down the other, but the bottom line of it is that the Supreme Court has upheld openness in a trial. And that has also led to some speculation about the ramifications of that. Now, while, you know, folks in the media are really, really thrilled with all of this, are there any subtleties or nuances to the idea that, you know, openness should be upheld unless there is this compelling interest? Are there any ramifications that you see that you think the rest of us need to be mindful of as we go forward?
Honestly, I think it's a good opinion. And the reason for that is because it leaves the judge with the option, if she finds or he finds a compelling reason, right, to narrowly tailor the closure to meet the purpose. And then notice has to be given to the public, right, that we're going to close this proceeding. And if somebody wants to be heard, they can be heard. But the judge and the court can still close the proceeding if they can show a compelling interest. And what the court is saying is, look, when you do this, when you show that interest, when you put it on the record, your reasons why, then we can look at it objectively and say, okay, that makes sense to us. But when you just shut off the media, when you close out the public, and you don't tell us why, right, you leave us with no choice. We have to be able to review your decision. How do we know your decision is right? You put your reasons on record. And they have to be objective reasons showing a compelling interest, and then you narrowly tailor the closure to meet that specific interest. If a juror has been threatened, right, physically by one party or the other, somebody that's related to the party, then the court can take the person back in chambers, put all this stuff on record, give notice to the side, and close it. Because someone's physical safety is paramount.
So you're really talking about in criminal cases where you have potentially organized crime or other situations where you're going to have one party potentially who's not even indicted yet, who might have some serious threats to his or her being.
Well, let's say that somebody comes in and accuses one of the jurors of maybe taking a bribe during the middle of a trial, right? You may not want that known because you don't know. There's not enough evidence. So to falsely accuse a juror of taking a bribe, some of those things may have to be done outside the public's view to maintain at least the sanctity of the trial.
Well, in this case, although there wasn't a bribe involved, wasn't there the whole issue about a juror potentially having information and all of that?
Yeah, but that was so speculative. I mean, you know, when you looked at it, it's like,
well, see, but that's the point. I mean, speculative is one thing, but knowledge is another, right?
So when the judge is making the record, the compelling interest, what's the compelling interest? We have a juror that's been threatened. We have a juror that's been a credible allegation of a bribe. And here are the reasons why I believe the allegations are credible, et cetera, et cetera. And here's why I'm shutting off the hearing to the public and to the media.
Do you think that those, all the reasons for compelling interest should be specified more narrowly?
No, because you never know what's going to happen in the trial. You know, I always tease you about getting your law license and practicing because you know a lot about the law. You never know what's going to happen. I mean, all kind of crazy. I mean, if anything, with the media presence now, going back to the OJ case, and it just gets stronger and stronger, we learn more about trials. We see more things that happen, right, that we wouldn't think, you know, so you don't know. And I think it's good to leave it to the trial court the way it is right now because there's an objective test that can be used and then reviewed by the higher court.
Is there anything that you see from this decision that you think the rest of us aren't paying attention to that we ought to look at a little bit more carefully?
No. Really, no, I think it's a great decision because it does balance my right, the defendant's right to a fair trial, Sixth Amendment right, against the public's right to access to it. Again, especially in this day and time, when you're talking about NSA and all the things that's going on in Big Brother, and all, we need to know that what's going on in court is just. And the only way to know that is to keep it open to the public. Right, wrong, or indifferent, there should be no secrets when it comes down to justice, especially like, and this is a great example, where there's really nothing other than speculation out there.
You sort of got into the next part of what I wanted to ask you about. Did this make us more ripe for having a decision like this from the Hawaii Supreme Court because we have such sensitivities to what happened with the NSA?
I think so. I think all of that, you know, all of that has shown, or this opinion has come out, during a period of time in our society to where transparency is a must, especially in the justice system. And I agree with you. I think that may have played a factor, at least in the climate of all this secrecy and, you know, with technology forever advancing. I mean, I'm watching opening statements online, right? I don't have to go to court anymore. There used to be a time when I tried murder cases that the courtroom was packed. And the Didi trial was like that. The public has an interest in these things. And when we have so much eavesdropping going on and concerns of privacy, I think this decision was right on time.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you.
Ken Lawson is a professor at the William S. Richardson School of Law, where he teaches criminal procedure, criminal law, professional responsibility, evidence, and the business of law practice.
In this morning's quiz, we told you about a famous first lady. She was perhaps best known for summering on the eastern seaboard, but on a vacation in our islands years ago, she was greeted at the airport by a crowd of over 5,000 people. Although she attended plenty of formal parties and functions over the course of her seven-week stay, she and her family found plenty of time to relax, far from the public eye. The governor asked the public to respect the former and first lady's privacy, and newspapers agreed not to follow our report on her and her family's daily activities. With her daughter, son, brother-in-law, niece, and nephew in tow, she vacationed across the islands, spending several weeks at the vast Portlock estate of industrialist Henry J. Kaiser and 10 days at a secluded beach campground on Kauai. In a letter written at the end of her stay in July of 1966, Jacqueline Kennedy wrote, "I hope the aloha spirit is contagious because it could change the world."
And Sherry called us from Honolulu with the answer, the correct answer. We had several other people call up with other answers, including Hillary Clinton and Lady Bird Johnson. But yes, of course, it was Jackie O. And we have a clip from her stay in Hawaii. It's on our Facebook page. That's our quiz for today. If you've got one for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Good morning. I'm Hank Rogers from Blue Startups. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
We can only imagine what Hawaii was like 200 years ago, but at least we could look at the state's historical societies to fuel our imaginations. The preservation of artifacts and historical records and works of art is an important mission for people like Sissy Lake Farm, the new executive director of the Bailey House Museum on Maui, which is owned and operated by the Maui Historical Society. Bailey House is the home of Edward Bailey, one of the fascinating figures of 19th century Hawaii, a man of many parts. His bicentennial celebration is tomorrow. Sissy is on the line to tell us about it. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Chris. Good morning.
What would Edward Bailey be best known as? I'm looking at some of his artworks, and they're really pretty lovely.
Yes. He came as a teacher, and he taught a school of young Hawaiian women at the female seminary school that was right here next to us at the Bailey House. So he came as an educator, as a missionary, but he later became a surveyor of land, and he was kind of a jack of all trades, so he did all kinds of things, as well as an artist. He was a self-proclaimed artist.
Well, the art has a very distinctive kind of color palette. I'm looking at Wailuku and the Iao Valley, and of course, when you look at this work, you're seeing a very untouched Maui, aren't you?
Yes, definitely. It helps to give us a perspective of what he saw back in the 1800s and helps to give us a very clear picture of pristine Maui back then. So nice.
Back in the 19th century, people had a wonderful capacity for writing letters, writing journals and diaries. Did he leave a lot of written materials as well?
He did. There were letters. There were maps that he helped because he was a surveyor. He did maps and also different deeds, agreements for land exchange and things like that.
So when you get visitors to Bailey House, mainland visitors, are they surprised to learn about the history of Hawaii? I don't think people on the mainland get that much, do they?
They do. They're very surprised. I think because the Iao Valley is a destination for most visitors here in Maui, and we're right on the way to Iao. It's nice when they come in and they're able to experience our museum because we're so lucky and so fortunate to have such a beautiful and the largest collection of artifacts and objects here of our, of Hawaiian history. So they do. It's like they come in and they're able to learn about here in Maui as well as the state of Hawaii and look at objects and things that were so important to our Hawaiian people and then also the missionary time with Edward Bailey.
What are some of the objects and artifacts you mentioned?
We have things that are from pre-contact. So we have what we call pohaku kuiai, which is poi pounders and different stone objects as well as things that were utilized like poi pounders, poi boards, beautiful umekes or containers that the Hawaiian people would utilize in their day-to-day life. Kapa, which was done their main source of clothing. Yeah, kapa beaters, advils that they utilize to make the kapa. And then also lauhala, different lauhala weavings and works. We have also weaponry. A nice array of things that, as well as post-contact, and when Edward Bailey came and utilized the household and taught the girls at the female seminary, his art works. There are 100, but we only have 26 in our collection. So.
There are literally hundreds of these.
100 paintings that he did in the course of his lifetime. So we only have a portion of those.
Given all the other things he did, Sissy, I'm surprised he found the time. Yeah?
Right, exactly. I'm surprised he found the time as well. And he's actually, like I said, he taught himself. He had friends that were artists, but he took it on upon himself to learn and to, because he was so involved in the land and the people, it's just such a nice way to be able to showcase to this day. We can look at these beautiful paintings and get a sense of what our Maui was like back then. And it's such a joy to be able to see and experience and, talk about, he kind of captured a day in the life of, whether it was a missionary, whether it was a Hawaiian or, and just the lovely geography of this island.
And I always think of museums, Sissy, as a place where, as places of the imagination in a sense, where everything that you see can sort of trigger an imagining of what you can never really know, which is what things were like two centuries ago, yeah?
Yes, exactly. We help to try, our volunteers do a really great job of trying to transport our visitors into another time and space and just give them a sense or, at least a little glimpse of what Hawaii was like and the true culture that we do have. Because I know here we're so, we have our tourism and there's such a commercial sense to what we do, which is fine. But it is nice for them to be able to come and experience, what truly our people were like and the type of history that we did contain here in Maui and the state of Hawaii.
And I would think that people would really welcome that opportunity, Sissy. And I thank you for talking with us this morning.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris.
Sure. Enjoy your bicentennial celebration, yeah? Sissy Lake Farm is the executive director of the Maui Historical Society, Bailey House Museum in Wailuku. The Society is hosting a celebration of Bailey tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. The event is free, and you can learn more at hpr2.org.
On Saturday, July 26th, slide guitar master Stephen George and multi-instrumentalist Larry Spalding bring the blues to HPR's Atherton Studio. Enjoy these veteran bluesmen in an evening of traditional country blues, contemporary songwriting, and a bit of Zydeco for added spice. That's July 26th at 7:30 p.m. For tickets, call 955-8821 during business hours or purchase online at hprtickets.org. I went
back to our old place. Beth Ann, I was glad you got a chance to talk to law professor Ken Lawson, because that Supreme Court decision earlier this week kind of raised the question from the media perspective of how much coverage of a trial proceeding is too much. I remember back when cameras in the courtroom were first introduced, I was a working news cameraman, and there was a lot of anxiety over what the presence of cameras in a court proceeding would do. That is now sort of settled in, but at the same time, you can go a little too far and mess up the way a trial is proceeding. And that's, I think, where the drawing of the line becomes important.
And what we saw with this one was a serious rebuke of the judge and her actions. You heard what Ken had to say, that this is a very, very good decision. And in terms of making a compelling argument for having to close the courtroom or to seal anything else, well, that would have to be pretty narrowly defined. That's going to do it for us for this week. We'll be back with you next week to have much more to talk about, and we will be looking at the Comcast Time Warner Cable merger. We're going to talk with Jay April from Maui's Akaku.
And how historical research can help restore family ties at Kalaupapa.
Let us in on your radio talkback. You can find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, tweet us at HI Conversation, or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
If you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find the playlist on our page at hpr2.org. That's also where you can listen back to today's show. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Taylor Rice is our production assistant. And Mark Sakamoto is our summer intern.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello, and I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Have a good weekend, and join us on Monday when we pick up the conversation.